And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Breon, Executive Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, and Andrew Tursky, Senior Equipment Editor for Golf.com as well. What's up, guys?
Pleasure to be here. Always an honor.
How's the week going?
It's going very well. Thank you for asking. I appreciate your concern.
Yeah, I'm very, very concerned for you, Andrew Tursky.
How's your week going?
All of us on the show are.
Timmy B, how's your week going?
It's going all right. Had got to do some work with some players this week, which was fun. Picking some new irons and new fairway woods, doing some work with Christy Kerr, so that was fun.
Nice.
Just got some new gear going in the bag.
I dig it.
Got some new gear going in the bag, playing a lot of TaylorMade gear, so... and then did a little work with Kevin this week as well, so should be fun. Get these guys back on the road and back to playing competitive golf. J-Walt, what's going on in your world?
Boys, a whole lot of golf equipment, like normal. I mean, what else do you expect?
That's our lives.
Yeah.
I know. We've got a bunch of product launches coming up too, which is...
gearing up.
Is exciting. Yeah, I know. It's almost that time of the year where you start to see manufacturers rolling out new product on a pretty regular cadence.
Yeah, and this is about the time for all you listeners out there when J-Wall starts to get moving on club test stuff. So it starts well in advance. It's not just put together 30 days ahead of the issue.
We might have a couple of new wrinkles this year, Professor, that you and I have been discussing a little bit. So I'm excited. You know, we completely revamped the last club test. It looked noticeably different from the previous ones. I wasn't involved with those, so wanted to shake things up, and we might be having a couple of new wrinkles. So
exciting. New age coming. Of the club test. Very exciting. Let's go.
So we have Tursky on board officially, so it'll be even better this time.
So we've got a great episode lined up for all you listeners out there. We've got a couple of tour topics, one regarding Tony Finau's driver, another one regarding Victor Hovland's irons. Both of those are ping topics for the week. And then from there, we've got a gear spotlight on a just newly released set of irons, which looks really, really cool. Was announced at the Memorial, a collaborative iron. And then we have a great mailbag question for the week regarding men's and ladies' products and the differences between men's and ladies' products. And then for our interview this week, we got to spend some time with Clay Long. For those folks that may not be familiar with Clay.
Legend.
Clay's kind of he's a lifer in this industry. He's worked with Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Greg Norman, and quite a few other players along the way. And, you know, his career speaks for itself. So,
Jack Nicklaus, ever heard of him?
He's definitely in the club design, and most recently he was with the boys over at TaylorMade. And now, recently, he's now started his new line of putters, and I believe he's got some wedges for available as well. So with that, let's get into our first topic for the week, Finau's driver. First thing I'll comment on here is it's not surprising to see a gear change just because Tony's been, I mean, everybody's known that Tony can hit the ball a really long ways, and that when you see him play on tour every week, that those, you know, 290, 310-yard drives are like half swings for him.
Yeah, and I was going to say, he hits it so long that he's been like reeling it back for his whole career.
His whole career, he's been just basically bunting it out there. And, well, now seeing Bryson DeChambeau and what he's doing in the golf courses, Tony's like, well, I can do that too. And
well, it's funny that Bryson's been working so hard and changing his body, doing all these things for basically a year. Changing his equipment, doing all this, and Finau's just like, oh, I can do that too. Like, I might as well do it.
Yeah, it's wild, right? But I guess we got a gear change that corresponds with this difference in strategy. Something going on with the loft on his driver, is that right?
Yeah. And you know, I go back to, I can't remember, it was within the last several years that Gary Player mentioned that there would be a golfer who would come along who would routinely hit the ball 400 yards, who would change the game. And I mean, I don't know about you guys.
We're closing
I think
in.
It's Bryson. You know, it's Bryson because look what's going on. He now has other players contemplating the idea of altering their drivers, maybe working out more. But you know, this kind of, I mean, Finau even admitted, he said that, you know, Bryson no doubt inspired him to kind of start working on his speed. And, you know, as you mentioned, one way to do that, get in the gym, bulk up, look like a linebacker like Bryson does right now. Or you can also alter your gear, and that's what Finau did. He was using an 8-degree Ping G410 Plus, and after some videos of him surfaced the week prior to Memorial, Kent Notes, Ping's tour rep, reached out to Finau and said, you know, look, I know you're hitting it north of 200 mile an hour ball speed, but like, look, is this for real? What are we doing here? And so Finau said, yeah, look, I want to get in the mid 90s up into, you know, high 90s, maybe 200 ball speed with the driver. And so they started working together at Memorial just to kind of see what that would look like. And they took off 3/4 of a degree of loft off his driver. So he's got his new driver head has an actual loft of 7.25 degrees. They put 5 grams of hot melt closer to the face. And Finau went from right around, you know, 3,200 RPMs a spin on the good ones, maybe up to 3,600 when he caught it low on the face, to now he was hitting it with this new driver setup, 2,700 RPMs. And he's down about a 0.5 degree with his launch. And ball speeds are still mid to upper 190s. And, you know, Kent went out on the golf course and said that he watched Tony on an uphill hole carry it 340, roll out and everything. It ended up about 370. And look, it's my question for you guys is, how many more players do you think we see this year go the Bryson route and try and alter their driver to get more distance?
And when do we see a long driver setup, like a real long driver setup?
That's a good question. I mean,
might be
sooner than later. It definitely could be.
That Bryson winning in Detroit was like one of the most impactful wins in a while. I feel like it really kind of freed people up to be like, okay, I can chase distance.
Well, you're not going to see, I don't think you're going to see driver lengths get longer than 46. So you're not going to see these 48-inch long drive shafts. When you look at, because the margin of error is so small as far as squaring up the club face when the shaft's that long.
What about
it's
people,
so difficult to control the face and hit it out of the middle.
What about people putting two drivers in, like the old Phil? You go with the long driver, and then you kind of go with like the three wood type driver.
I could see players that don't need three woods anymore doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of have a driver set up to drive more accurately, and then you have one that's set up to just rip at. Maybe you see something like that. My biggest thing is you're already seeing, you know, what I would characterize as more long drive type heads being used. You know, with Bryson using a sub-6-degree driver. And
what do long drivers use? Like typically around that, like 4, 5, 6?
I've worked with a fellow that finished third in Worlds two years ago, and mm-hmm. he was using a 4-degree turn down to a 2. So he had less loft
turned
on his,
down to 2.
He had less loft on his driver.
What
than
shafts
do
they play?
They play, you know, there was a, back when it was Matrix. Matrix, you know, had a specialty product called House of Forged that
that
was just for them. Patterson does a great job of making long drive shafts.
Like, what's the stiffness? What kind of CPM are we talking about?
Well, remember, they're playing it so much longer than a typical driver that the CPM doesn't correlate just because of the fact that you're playing something that's 2 inches longer. So the CPM has to correlate to the length. But if you were looking at, like, relative flex, you know, a lot of these are, some guys are using stuff that is more flexible than you would think, meaning only a single or double X. Other guys are using stuff that's up close to triple or quadruple X. It just depends on like what they need. Like this one long driver that created a lot of lead deflection at impact would turn a 2-degree driver into a 14-degree driver because the shaft was bending forward so much.
Like if I tried to hit a long driver's driver,
you wouldn't
what would happen? Really?
You wouldn't get airborne. It would go straight. It would go about 10
now
feet.
Now we got to test it out and see what happens.
I mean, there's nothing that we could do from here on out. I have to go to TrueSpec like right now and go
test
it. You
would figure it out after probably 2 or 3 swings. You would start making compensations to like lift the ball up in the air and lean back and all sorts of stuff because you're a good enough player that you'll figure it out. But the first couple
Thank
shots,
you. Thanks for
the first couple shots you're going to hit just dead right and really low, most likely.
Okay. I'm excited to try it out. Do you guys have any over there, or should I procure one of my own?
I've got some stuff. I got stuff you can use.
All right.
But I don't think you're going to see tour players going to 48-inch builds on drivers just because, you know, they do still have to hit it accurately, you know. The thing to remark about with Bryson is that, yeah, he's bombing it out there 380, but he's actually hitting more fairways now than he was prior to this change, or just as many fairways.
Which is crazy.
And this is just, this is crazy, right? So to think of picking up 80 yards of distance off the tee and actually hitting it more accurately, like...
Well, that's why, apparently, that's why they built that LA golf shaft for him.
Well,
that he could grow into.
It's definitely shown... It's definitely shown, you know, a marked performance, especially with the players that I've used with it, when people swing harder at it. Mm-hmm. So when somebody swings really hard, harder than normal, it actually tends to be more stable. And I don't know, I've mentioned this to a couple folks in the shaft industry outside of the guy that designed it, John Oldenburg, and they can't really speak to the how, you know, that's contrary to basically any other shaft I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. Anytime you go strong, you know, you try to swing faster, usually your margin of error is worse, not better. So in any event, I do think you're going to see these folks go into lower lofts, though. You know, sub 6 degree, 5 degree, 5.5 degree, 6 degree lofts. I think that's something.
Finau was talking about testing 6.75.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, what did Tiger used to play? He used to play something pretty flat faced.
Yeah, but this is a totally different design, though. So that you got to remember
seven and a half.
That in the initial big-headed drivers, so they didn't quite, I think those initial ones were in the 300, 350 cc range, that the sole plates on those things were much heavier than the sole plates on them now. And so the center of gravity was much lower, and it tended to spin the ball a lot more. And so I think it's important to understand that, like, looking at the lofts of those first renditions of, like, the larger-sized heads, that loft... it's not relatable to today because they're using carbon fiber in the sole and they're doing other things.
Yeah.
And the CG isn't quite as low as it used to be in some cases. So, but I do think you're going to see guys adopting this, you know, I don't even know if it's bomb and gouge. It's something beyond bomb and gouge at this point. I don't know what the term for it is.
We need a new term.
Because it's not bomb and gouge anymore.
It's just like reckless abandon.
Yeah.
Just swing as hard as you can.
Yeah, so... now, the interesting thing was, is, you know, we didn't really talk about Bryson on the pod this week. You know, he made a 10 that he made before he missed the cut in his last event?
Is this our Bryson weekly segment?
I think
coming
so.
Coming up right now? Yeah. Okay, all right, cool.
The 10 that he made? So
I'm in. Let's just do... I mean, we're already doing a weekly segment with Bryson anyway. So.
Yeah. We've already been... We've all been there, though. Yeah. You know, you make a 10, it starts going downhill in that hole.
Yeah, of course. But
I felt for him.
So I do think you're going to see lower lofts. I don't think you're going to see long, super long shafts. You may see longer shafts with some of these guys. They may go to 46 when they're used to playing 45. But then you look at, you know, Tony last year picking up both club head and ball speed, you know, going to a shorter length. So... But
it's interesting. There's been a couple different guys that are going to shorter lengths.
And hitting it further, actually. Yeah. So I think for every player, it's just different depending upon the way that they swing and the way that they you know, deliver the club. And so
I like it, though. We got two different trends going on at the same time.
Yeah, and then, you know, look at Gary Woodland losing a ton of weight. Yep. And then you got Bryson gaining a ton of weight. So you've got, like, it's kind of all over the place right now, all kind of going to the same goal, which is... You know,
win tournaments.
So, so with all that, we also had an iron change out on tour. We've got Victor Hovland, who's not a stranger to changing irons.
No, he changes a bunch. He was hard to keep track of there for a while, like even knowing what model he had in the bag.
Hovland was Bryson for us early on when we started the pod. I think we had Hovland discussions for probably 4 or 5 weeks straight, wasn't it? I mean, wouldn't that say it was accurate?
I remember he had 2 weeks in a row where he had scoring irons and blueprints and long irons and I-210s, and then the next week
he
switched it.
He flipped
it.
Them.
He flipped it. where he went I-210s in the scoring irons and blueprints in the long irons.
Then went all I-blades. And then the next week he went all only in the long irons. He was all over the map.
He had success
with all of these changes. It wasn't like he was doing it.
So wait a minute. He's really good at golf. This was when he was in the middle of his 60s streak, when he was shooting all those rounds in the 60s. So he never shot 70 or higher, changing his gear like almost tournament to tournament, almost round to round.
I think if he was a full tour member at the time when I was going through the numbers, I think he would have ranked first or second in strokes gained approach. Mm-hmm.
That's super weird
on tour. I mean, it was crazy. He was just shooting darts, and
didn't matter what you gave him.
Irons.
Yeah. So he's been kind of quiet for a while on the iron front. I know he just like adjusted some lofts right before Bay Hill to get the ball going a little flatter, but he made some pretty significant changes ahead of last week. Jay Wall had the scoop on it, so I'll let him tell you what was going on.
Yeah, this one, of the two, between Finau making the driver change and the iron change for Hovland, I think Hovland by far is the more intriguing of the two stories. So I guess Hovland, for as great of a ball striker as he is, it's interesting. He kind of is a course superintendent's dream. He picks the ball and doesn't make really, really deep divots. Everything's been pretty shallow for him. And again, Kent Notes, who's Ping's tour rep, said that, if anything, Hovland's probably more of an underspinner. Just doesn't really generate a lot of spin. Enough for him most weeks to get by and to have success. But for what they were about to encounter at Jack's place, they tore up literally as the final groups are on the back nine, they are tearing up the greens.
You saw the photo that they posted?
Yes.
Yeah, literally while the tournament's still going on, they're ripping
rolling,
up the green.
They're rolling. Yeah, they're rolling up the turf on the greens.
They couldn't wait to get that tournament still going.
It was crazy. I mean, they have basically a year to get the golf course ready for next year's tournament. So anyway, as Hovland's kind of preparing, he played the week prior, which was work day. And as he's kind of getting ready, there was rumblings that Jack was going to make the golf course play noticeably different last week. During the workday event, it was shorter rough, tees were up, greens were a little bit more receptive. The week later, the rough has grown up substantially. I don't even know if they cut it between when they started that tournament the week prior and then the week, because they played 2 weeks back to back at Muirfield Village, if people didn't realize that. So Jack wanted to firm up the greens too. So Hovland thought, this is probably a good week to maybe kind of look at trying to generate a bit more spin. So found out that actually the week of Colonial, the first week back for the tour, Ping had kind of discussed with Hovland the idea of maybe making a change to his irons. But he had just making his way back, wanted to try and find a groove. And so he found like Memorial was a good week to try something out. And this is an interesting one, Tim. And I'll kind of want to see what you think about maybe a recreational player doing this. But to try and generate more spin, Hovland didn't want to adjust lofts. He didn't want to adjust shaft length. He didn't want to do anything that would mess with his specs. What Ping proposed to him was grinding the camber off the bottom of the sole. So they took 4 degrees off the camber on each one of his irons. And then actually the 52 and the 56 that he carries in the Ping Glide threes, they took off 2 degrees off of both of those wedges, but nothing off the lob wedge. And what they found by grinding off the camber from the soles was that Hovland was able to generate about 150 to 200 RPMs of additional spin. He gained 1 degree of launch, and that translated to a steeper landing angle by 2 degrees. So pretty similar numbers. He maybe got an extra yard or two of carry with each, but he didn't want to change a lot of variables, just wanted to add spin. And this is what he found out, was that by removing this camber from the sole, it allowed him to interact a little bit more with the turf. The ball raises up a little bit higher on the face. He gets more spin. So have you ever heard about something like this, Tim? And what would you think about a recreational golfer doing something like this?
I have heard of something similar here. And basically they're playing with vertical strike point on the face is what they're doing. They're changing
right.
They're changing one thing. They're changing the CG of the club slightly. So by removing weight from the bottom of the club, that moves the CG just a hair higher. And then by changing the geometry of the sole, it's changing the way that the sole is interacting with the ground, which is also going to change where the ball strikes on the face. So, you know, it's kind of very fine-tuning. As far as would I suggest this for the average golfer, absolutely not. So when you're talking about, like, camber from leading edge to trailing edge, that camber is actually kind of important because the average golfer delivers the club with more variation than a tour pro does.
Everyone picks it like Hovland.
Exactly right. So having that camber on the bottom is something that's actually very helpful. You know, we're going to have an interview in just a little bit with Clay Long, and he talks about, you know, the player that he designed for so many years, Jack Nicklaus, wanting a very flat sole.
Completely flat.
Yeah, flat enough to be able to rest on a table. And there's a secondary piece to that too, which is even if you design a very flat sole, if the CG of the club is not very neutral, it won't stand, you know, straight up. It'll tip over. So in order to take a golf club and rest it flat on its sole on the table and have it stand straight up, it tells you two things. Number one, there's not any camber from front to back. And it also tells you that the CG location is probably pretty neutral. And it's not too far forward or too far back compared to most, you know, a lot of designs. But when we're talking about, like, should the average golfer do this? Probably not. Just because.
There you go. Just, don't do it.
Just because.
It's entertaining, though. It's entertaining to read about.
Yeah, just because of the fact that, like, removing that camber and making the sole of the club very, very flat, you're taking away margin of error and forgiveness. You're also changing the bounce.
And a regular golfer would just dig straight into the turf, right?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends upon their angle of attack and what they tend to do, whether they tend to hit the ground first or whether they tend to hit thin shots. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some type of players that if they're super shallow and they're playing on really, really thin, tight, firm turf, this may actually benefit them a little bit. But once again, they have to deliver it very consistently. But if you're a steep player or if you're inconsistent with the way you deliver it, you know, from angle of attack standpoint, if you are inconsistent about, you know, strike pattern, meaning hitting the ball first and hitting it in the same place on the face, you probably want to have some forgiveness in the sole of the club. So, and speaking of the flat-bottomed golf clubs, it's a perfect segue into...
What a transition.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, wow, did you script man. That?
Yeah, that's pretty good,
you,
right?
You had to have planned that.
So we've got two things that kind of play into that idea coming up here on the pod. The first one is our gear spotlight for the week, which is a new release from Mira, and it's a collaborative iron with Jack Nicklaus and Nicklaus Companies. So you guys have seen the irons, as have I. They're really beautiful, aren't they?
Fire.
Yeah, I mean, my question is, would you play them?
Nope.
If you had a set of these irons?
Absolutely not.
Nope.
That's no art. They're art. You hang them on the wall. You get a nice case for them.
So they're wall hangers. You don't believe in the tools, not jewels?
Not for these.
Well, do you get two sets, and one's a wall hanger, and one you get out and...
Well, you could get like three pitching wedge, probably not be able to hit the three iron and just keep the three iron in the trophy.
They're almost $2,800. So, I mean, I guess if you got deep pockets, you could buy.
That's cheap. That's cheap for artwork.
Two or three sets.
That's right.
A Basquiat painting for like 380 mil.
But it's cheap. You know, you're talking about the legendary forging house of Mira, right? And what does Mira represent? Well, there's a reason why so many tour players, for so many years, sought products that were actually fabricated there. They may have had stamps from other manufacturers on them. So when you look at it, you know, Mira's collaborated with a lot of companies, actually, mm-hmm. to design irons that they just kind of flown under the radar.
And players.
You know, we had Mr. Shinye Mira-san on the pod, you know, before this whole COVID thing happened, right around the waste management time. And, you know, they've been known as one of the premier forging houses because they have a unique process that they use. Then obviously you have the legacy of Jack Nicklaus, who, as I've said before, for my money, he's still the GOAT. I know that Tiger had a 10-year stretch. That 10-year stretch that Tiger had was the best 10-year stretch of any player ever.
He also won the 2019 Masters. I don't know if you knew that.
He did. But but when you look at, you know, 30-year playing career and everything that Jack did, it's pretty amazing. So
yeah, A lot of second places in majors as well.
18 of them or something like that.
The resume. Yeah.
So
the collaboration here, guys, I think is actually really cool. You know, this to me, this collaboration between Mira and Jack Nicklaus is kind of what we've seen in the shoe space. You know, you get collaborations, not just players. I'm not talking about, you know, Jordans or other athletes, but other designers, maybe they're not shoe designers, that enter the space, and they
Abloh.
This to me, you know, again, and granted, this is not somebody from outside the golf space, but it is really cool to see Mira and Jack collaborate on this. You know, it kind of started back in 2014 when Jack made a trip to Mira headquarters and sat in the one position chair, which is Mira-san's chair. Only person who's ever sat in that chair on the grinding line, and Jack sat in it. It's kind of a cool story, you know, just how, you know, Mira-san talked about it being the greatest day of his life. I'm sure he's had a bunch of great days, but you know, I know it's special to have Jack there, and that kind of started a little bit of a dialogue. So yeah, these irons are really special, and I'm pretty sure they're gonna sell out.
Oh yeah, quickly, very quickly. I don't know how many pieces are they coming out with.
I don't think they made a firm number on the number of sets.
Okay.
So
here's the question coming out of this.
I'm assuming it's limited, and if it's limited, they're selling out quick. But yeah.
I would assume. So
Tiger's probably not going to be on staff with TaylorMade for the remainder of his time in the golf space, I'd have to think, at some point. You know, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't.
You said he's not going to be?
Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. Maybe that's aggressive speculation. But either way, do we see Tiger Woods have his own club company at some point?
That's what I was going to say. If he's not on staff with TaylorMade, what's he doing?
Because remember, Jack did this.
TGR blades. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, he did play those for a little bit.
Do we ever see Tiger?
But he didn't do it at that point, and I feel like that was the time where he would have done it if he was going to.
Do we ever see it?
I don't know.
I don't think we do.
We've obviously seen his own line of clubs, you know, the P7 TWs and, you know, Tiger Woods specials, but I don't know, his own brand, his own company.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a tough space.
He throws himself in, you know, into whatever he's doing, whether it's working with kids and his foundation. You know, he's involved in a lot of things off the golf course. But I mean, you look at it, Tiger throws his entire self into whatever projects he's doing. So,
yeah,
I know this know,
is
much.
He willing to, that's, is he that's willing why to he do might that with
not,
golf equipment?
That's why he that's might not do thinking. It though. Yeah.
If he just came out with a line of junior clubs, they'd be the number one selling junior clubs in the industry.
By far.
Now that would be an interesting one if he entered the junior
that
golf
was,
space.
So when TaylorMade introduced the Rory set, right?
They should have the little Frank logo.
I really thought they were going to use the Tiger Woods brand equity to do a junior set, you know, a Tiger set. It makes perfect sense.
I think Rory has a set, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's what I was just saying.
Yeah, Rory does. Yeah.
That's what I was just saying. You look at TaylorMade, they have the Rory set, and that's something that they've catered to the junior golf market, meaning the younger players, the players that shouldn't be playing, you know, regular size adult clubs.
That would absolutely work if Tiger had junior clubs. Michael Jordan had junior clubs with Wilson.
That's what I'm saying, man. So
still can't believe that.
Maybe we'll see some more collaborations. These irons, as we mentioned, they look beautiful, though. Obviously, you have all the benefits of being Mira forged, and then you have all of the branding elements and some of the design ideas that Jack had incorporated for years into their design.
Flatter
I'm
sole.
At them right now. They got the yellow golden bear.
Little golden bear. Like that's right. So,
sweet.
You know, talking about junior clubs and adult clubs, I think it's a perfect segue into. Oh man, I'm killing these segues.
Transition
today.
Game.
Another
on
one of these
point.
Clean segues from the professor. Wow.
Yeah.
Timmy B came prepared today.
So I think that's perfect segue into the mailbag question for the week, Jonathan. What do you got on mailbag?
Shout out Scoot23,
Scoot
on Instagram for the great question this week. Who asks? Is there any differences in ladies' club heads versus men's? For instance, is a ladies' Cobra F9 driver head the same as the men's, or do they have different weights lie angles, etc.
Good question from Scooter McGavin.
Yeah, it's great.
Let me just say this: we don't talk enough about women's golf clubs. It'd be cool to get, you know, Christy Kerr or, you know, some of these. Tim's got a deep Rolodex of you know, female golfers that he works with. We got to get some more. I know we had Christy on at one point, but we need to get some more on.
We can definitely do that.
Because they swing about the same swing speed as an average male golfer. It's like, I don't know why more male golfers don't look at the launch monitor numbers for the players on the LPGA. I mean, that's your swing speed. You're not swinging as fast as the guys on the PGA Tour.
The average 50 to 65 year old, you know, the average 50 to 65 year old male is swinging about the same speed as an LPGA Tour pro. So when you look at, you know, the clubs that fit an LPGA Tour pro, there's going to be, especially shafts, you're going to see that there's definitely a lot more similarities to what fits an LPGA Tour player relative to the average player than what you get out of a tour player fit, meaning PGA Tour player. So, but it's a great question. What's the difference between ladies and men's clubs? In some cases, it's just a paint job. And as we know, paint actually can affect weight a little bit, but in this case, it's not really going to do that so much.
How many cases? Like, what's the percentage of that
of where the head is actually legitimately different?
Yeah.
So one thing to keep in mind is that sometimes they'll have to engineer the heads differently as far as gram weight. Because remember, the standard length of a ladies club is going to be an inch shorter than a men's club, typically, maybe even more in some cases. So when you're talking about, you know, the swing weight that's desired by the club designer, like if they want this thing to be in the upper B range for a lady, they need to make sure that the head weight is appropriate, you know, to be played at a shaft that's that length. So with some products, I would say it's probably 60-40 club heads that are basically the same as the men's that are just painted differently versus 40% where there's actually something different about them.
It's more the grip diameter in the shaft, right?
Yeah, that's most of the manufacturers, you know, from a dollars and cents standpoint, they don't want to have to design, you know, two different sets of club heads for different genders. They'd rather have one that they can use other characteristics of the golf club, because obviously that's just a more economical way to do it. But you do find plenty of ladies clubs that are specialized. And then that's the other part here, is that each brand, to my knowledge, has a specialty ladies set, which is, you know, engineered in many cases to help ladies, especially ladies that are beginning, with some of the issues that they may have. When you look at some of the typical issues that some ladies have, generating spin. So they're going to help hit the ball in the air. They're going to help generate spin. When you look at like the soles are going to be really cambered and really forgiving, really wide in many cases. A lot of the ladies' sets tend to have a very early transition into hybrids. So they may go through 8-iron on a regular iron design, and then the 7-iron starts to look like a hybrid. By the time you get to the 6-iron, it is a hybrid. Mm-hmm. So there can be a lot of differences between men's and ladies from a club head standpoint. Sometimes it's just paint, sometimes it's just weight, sometimes it's actual differences in CG and stuff like that. That's a lot more rare.
What percentage of male golfers, in your opinion, should be playing ladies clubs or have at least one ladies club in the bag?
I would say anybody that's swinging a driver 80 miles an hour or slower, not necessarily a ladies club head, but, you know, something that, should you consider a ladies flex shaft if you're a guy? It's all about speed. At the end of the day, the golf ball doesn't know anything about gender or age. It knows club head speed. And if your club head speed and delivery pattern is within a certain envelope,
So tuck the ego away and just look at the numbers.
Just look at the numbers.
What feels right in your hand.
Look at the numbers.
Some of the color schemes on these women's clubs are pretty heat. Fire, I gotta heat. Say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll always remember I fit this woman. I believe she was the curator of the Guggenheim Museum up in New York, or had some primary role up there. Yeah. So I'll always remember this. Ready? So ready? This is a great story. So she
Isn't
rolls
there a
in.
Seinfeld episode about George
designing
the Guggenheim.
So this woman episode. She rolls in and she's got her sky blue amp cell from Cobra. Remember those?
Yep.
She's got a sky blue Amcel driver at 46 inches. Okay. And she had it reshafted, but it was her husband's hand-me-down. And this woman could play. She was probably a 14, 15 handicap. And over the last couple of years, really was playing poorly. That's why she came in for a fitting. It's like, you know, I used to be able to break 80, you know, every once in a while, break 90 every time. And she's like, now I can't break 90. So I'm watching her hit this driver, and it's 46 inches, and it's an E2 swing weight.
Wow.
E2. And I'm just going, what's going on here? Like, how did you ever used to hit this thing any good? Turns out she never hit it any good. When that driver went in, when that driver went in play, was
that.
When that driver went in play, it correlated perfectly to when her skill set started to decline.
Right.
And I'm telling her, I'm like, you know, hey, like, this one over here is better. And she's like, well, what's the difference? I'm like, well, for number one, this one is like a C1 swing weight. This one is E2. She's like, well, what's the difference? This one feels fine. And she picks up her club. And I'm like, so I broke it down to her. I was like, Tiger Woods plays like D4, D5. And you're playing something that's significantly heavier than that.
Absolute shovel, E2.
Yeah. But then we ended up fitting her into a Callaway XR. A Callaway XR, it was amazing. 13.5 degrees turned up. Mm-hmm. It's basically a big-headed three-wood. Closed face. She never hit a slice anymore. This was amazing. Hits one ball with it. It goes 60 yards past her amp cell. 60 yards, 6-0. Hands it back to me and says, can't do this. And I'm looking at her going, you hit one shot and it's 60 yards further and you can't hit the club. I'm like, what's the issue? And she's like, it was a black matte club head. It's ugly.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, and then it hit me. I'm like, well.
Bring the spray paint out.
That's what I said. I said,
light blue, and then we're good.
I said to her, I was like, listen, there's a CVS around the corner. I can go get some nail polish. I can put some pretty designs on the top of it. But I can't let you leave here without this driver.
You could fix that issue.
It's going 60 yards further. You can't, like, you can't turn your back on this.
How much weight does nail polish add to the crown of your driver?
See, now J-Wall's starting to think.
Goes from C1 to C2.
That's right. It adds at least 2 points. But it's not E2.
It in there at least 2 points.
Least 2 points, but
an
E2.
We need to test this. I don't know how much I believe this paint conspiracy theory.
Maybe it acts like having turbulators on the crown, too. Maybe we're on to something.
Yeah, right.
Here.
Makes it more aerodynamic.
We got some aerodynamic features.
How do you hit it so far? Well, I got a bunch of this nail polish on the crown.
I let J-Wall's daughter have at my driver head last night.
Finger painting.
When you're talking men's and ladies' heads, it really depends. You have to do some research and find out if it's a difference in head weight. Generally, they try to keep the shaping the same. Obviously, there's a lot of branding that goes into this, so they want to try to keep the product looking similar. Now, one thing I will say is for a junior golfer that's transitioning from those entry starter sets like US Kids Golf and some of the other ones that exist La Jolla, when they're transitioning out of those into regular adult clubs, the perfect transition in many cases is a lady set, especially if it's a lighter head weight. So if it's a driver.
My first real driver actually had a lady shaft in it. It was like a men's Great Big Bertha club head. And then I put a lady shaft into it. Yep. You know, I was skinny and small and no speed.
I'll always remember the first junior tournament I ever played. I actually was paired with Bubba Watson. And I step up on the first tee and there's this lefty kid in knickers. His dad's got this curly Q Mr. Pringles mustache, and he's got a flaming pink driver shaft in his driver with like tennis tape swirled down the shaft. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what's going on here? I shot like a one or two over par, amazing at like 9 or 10 years old. He smokes me and shoots like 65 or something stupid. But I'll always remember seeing, like, he didn't care what it looked like.
Yeah.
If Bubba doesn't care what it looks like, why does Joe Brown, the average golfer?
I'm almost positive Freddie Couples played, like, ladies' irons or ladies' flex irons.
That was the last point I was going to make before we get into our interview for the week. So one of the best ladies' club stories as it relates to the PGA Tour is Freddie Couples.
I didn't mean to ruin your story. I knew about it.
So Freddie Couples, and I can actually testify to this. Freddie Couples played out of South Florida, you know, throughout his time. And South Florida PGA had this thing where they brought a bunch of junior golfers together. And then all the junior golfers, they picked 18 players. Mm. And they all would play one hole with Freddie. So I got picked when I was a kid. And I got to play a hole with Freddie at, like, Boca Resort and Club or something like that. And I'll always remember like him teeing off with his three wood, and I look over at it, and it's like full on ladies three wood. I'm like, what's going on over here? Come to find out, like partially through rumor, I guess it was Tom Watson's wife's three wood, and there was some reason why he had played it and ended up going in play. And he actually played events with this ladies three wood.
It's amazing
that he would bomb out there like 300 yards. You know, I don't know the accuracy of some parts of this story, but I can say that I saw a ladies three wood in the set, and I'm going, what's going on over here? This is weird.
Just goes to show you, don't be too proud, because Freddie's like the coolest cat there is.
And right?
If he can make it work with the ladies club, so can you.
Listen, you know, we got to finish up your fitting. Maybe you need a ladies hybrid in there.
All right. Well, you know, let's get to this interview. People have been asking about where's the fitting video, where's the driver fitting. It's coming soon. Yeah. We're doing the driver fitting this week. We
had
a little delay because of the coronavirus, but it'll be up soon.
Back on track, folks.
Yep.
And with that, let's get into our interview for the week. This week we had an opportunity to spend some time with Clay Long. His reputation precedes him throughout gearheads in the world. He's worked with the best players in the game. Most recently with the big OEMs, he worked, spent some time with TaylorMade doing some wedge work and some putter work with them. He now has his own putter company. Without further ado, let's get to Clay.
Clay Long.
So, folks, we have the honor and privilege of having a really special guest on this week. His name is Clay Long. Clay's reputation in the industry, the great Clay Long, his reputation precedes him in the industry. We'll let him get a little bit into that as we get into the interview. Clay, thanks for joining Fully Equipped.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, you know, for all of our folks out there that may not be familiar with Clay, he has worked for quite a few OEMs. He's done some amazing work. I believe, Mr. Long, you are one of the only guys that can claim that you have worked with Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus throughout your career, designing, building, and fitting golf clubs for both of those two iconic players.
That is true. That is true. Maybe somebody else has, but that's one distinction I have in all these years of dinking around with golf clubs, which is pretty special.
So, before we get into the meat and potatoes of the interview here, I heard a story about your first time at Augusta. I think it was your first time at Augusta. Now, we have kind of a running joke here on Fully Equipped. Our other co-host who wasn't able to join us, Jonathan Wall, he's obviously been able to play the golf course a few times with all of his media credentials over the years, and I've been fortunate enough to get out there a couple times myself through different connections that I've been able to get through the industry. But I heard that your first time out at Augusta was pretty different from most people's experience.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was funny. One of the guys in marketing, when I was working over at TaylorMade, he came in one day and says, I had gone to play it with a friend of mine a month ahead of time. He wanted to write a little story about, tell him about, you know, playing Augusta. And he sits down in my office and he says, so tell me about the first time you ever played Augusta. And he's thinking, I'm going to tell him about the trip I just went on, you know.
Right.
And I sat there and I said, well, the first time, the first time I ever set foot on a place is not exactly what you think I'm going to tell you. And so I told him the story about, it was in 1977. A friend of mine and I went to play in the Southern Amateur at Snee Farm in Charleston. And we drove all the way over there from Mississippi. And we missed the cut. And so we were driving back through Augusta. You know, that's right on 20. So we decide, you know, we don't know. We decide we're going to try to see if we can drop by Augusta National and maybe get a tour. Because it was in the middle of the summer. You know, it was in July. So we drive down Washington Street and we pull up to the front gate and the gate's open. And so we pull right in there by the guard shack and the guard walks up and we tell him, you know, what we're doing. We're coming from the Southern Amateur. We're going back to Mississippi. And we just want to know if there was like a bus tour or something, you know, where we could like see Augusta. And he says, oh, you know, he said, of course, we don't know. He says, oh, no, it's closed. In the summertime, there's nobody here but me and the caddy master. And you couldn't get in anyway. And, you know, nobody gets in here. We said, oh, okay. Well, you know, we just thought we'd check it out. And he says, you guys pretty good players? And we said, yeah, we both college players, you know. So he says, well, he says, if I let you come in, will you take a look at my swing?
Wow.
And we said, sure. So he says, okay, I'll tell you what. He says, the only reason I'm up here at the gate, I'm waiting for my wife to bring me a sandwich. Otherwise, it'd just be locked. You know, he says, so drive on down Magnolia, drive right down the front, park in front of the clubhouse, and I'll be along in just a few minutes, and we'll hit some balls. So we did. We pulled in there. There's nobody there. He comes up in a few minutes. We got our practice sacks with us, you know, because we're, you know, in those days, you hit your own balls. We hit a few balls there on the front of the range and looked at his swing. He's a Pinkerton guard.
Hitting your own range balls at Augusta. I love it.
Yeah, and picked them up. And then he says, y'all want to go play a few holes? And we said, yeah, great. So we get on the back of his cart, and we ride over to play. Now, there aren't any pins in the greens.
Right.
The greens aren't – they're not mowed down or anything. They're, you know, they're right. Cut. But so we played 10, 11, 12, and 13. And then he had to go punch a clock. You know, so many minutes he has to go at certain places. And so we played 10, 11, 12, 13, drove back up to the clubhouse and went in the clubhouse and sat in there and talked to the caddy master for half an hour.
Wow.
Inside, you know, walked around and looked at Jones's clubs and all the stuff that at that time that no one ever got to see or go in.
Nobody got to do that.
So I don't know. We must have stayed there about, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half. And there wasn't anybody there but him and the caddy master. And so then we thanked him and, you know, and got in the car and left. And of course I thought that's probably the only time I'll ever set foot on Augusta National, you know, and we didn't really realize, we didn't even know it was closed in the summertime. We didn't know anything about it. So I sent the guy a box of cigars when I got back home. So that was the first time I ever, you know, actually set foot on Augusta National. And so that was 77. In 1981, I had just started working over at McGregor. I'd been over there, I don't know, maybe a year. And I was playing a little competitive golf in the state, amateur golf. And I met a guy that I had played against in college when I was at Ole Miss and he was at Georgia. And we got friendly playing, I think, in the mid-am, the first mid-am up in Belrive. And so anyway, he comes down to we got to talking and I said, you need to come down and get a really good set of custom irons made down in the custom department at McGregor.
Right.
Cause they're like, that's the world-class place to get great blades built. And he said, I might do that. So he comes down and he brings a persimmon driver of his father's persimmon driver. It was an MT turning with aluminum insert, same exact driver I used. And he says, my dad wants to know if you can copy this driver. And I said, we can copy. Absolutely. I know right where those are 1172 turnings. I know right where there's a box of them because I've messed around with my own. And so anyway, so we made him a set of irons. We made his daddy a a copy of the driver and shipped them all up. And this wasn't a freebie. This was, you know, this was
right.
Paying and all. And so I get this handwritten note about a week after we shipped those clubs from Mr. Yates, who was the father. And the note says he was just thrilled with the driver. It was, he had never been able to get a good copy before. And he was so appreciative that we could do that. And he would like to know if I could join him and his son at Augusta National on March the, whatever it was, 13th or something, to play Augusta National. And I'm and I'm like, go play Augusta National? Or what in the, so I called my buddy Danny on the phone. I said, Danny, I got this note from your dad. And he said, oh yeah. He says, my dad's a member at Augusta.
Wow. So, Danny Yates, really good player, yeah. Danny Yates. That was
he's a great player. And we've been friends 40 something years. Anyway, so I drove up from Albany and drove up on a Saturday morning and we met up there, and here I am now officially at Augusta.
Right.
And we played golf in the morning. It was a beautiful 70 degree day, not a cloud in the sky. I played great. I shot 71 from the back. You know, you could just put a fork in me. And we spent the night in the clubhouse and ate dinner there and got up the next morning and played again, played the par three. And it was just it was just one of those kind of unreal experiences. And
yeah, sounds pretty surreal.
And it,
how different was the layout back then when you played it?
Well, I hit all the same clubs then that you saw people hit on TV. You know, I hit 6-iron into 18. I hit 6-iron into 11. I hit an 8-iron into 10.
I couldn't imagine hitting a 6-iron or 5-iron into 11. Like, that's just crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, you hit a good tee shot down there, and you hit 165 yards or so, you know, left right in there. It was just like, it was so awesome because it played just like you watched them on TV at the time. You know, yeah. I was hitting, you know, relatively the same. And then I played it again later, I don't know, like in 03 or something, after they lengthened it the first time. And it was so, we played from the back, and it was in December, and it was so long. Like, just brutally long compared to the first time I played it. But
I did want to ask about the dining experience at Augusta National, because everyone says you could just, like, get whatever you want. There's no menu. Is that true? And what did you get?
Well, I've told this story about at breakfast that first morning when we're sitting there with the Yates, and the waiter comes up to the table, and we're sitting there and talking, you know, and he says, "What would you like?" And so I'm looking around, looking for a menu, you know, looking for something to order, and there's no menu there. And he says, I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, what would you like? Just whatever you want. You just tell me."
That's awesome. Sign me up.
And that was kind of a, you know, sort of a just a little thing you remember about. I remember particularly that first trip. I think you could wear cleats in the dining room even. I mean, we were wearing metal cleats.
Wow.
I think. I don't remember taking our shoes off. Honestly, you felt really at home. It didn't feel like you might think it would be being at Augusta. You know, it felt like you're there to play golf, and this is a golf place, and you're there to play golf, and you're a golfer. And
yeah,
it was just, you felt real, I felt real at ease with the whole atmosphere there. It was phenomenal to be there and feel that way. You know, it was great.
Well, with that, let's get into some gear. I know Andrew was reading a story that about kind of your start in the industry. I know he was curious, you know, how you ended up in the industry. Obviously, lifelong golfer, but, you know, a lot of us find our way into the equipment side of the world with unique stories.
Yeah, so I was reading that you started at college. We're actually working at a paper company, and I guess a headhunter from the golf industry came and wanted to hire you, and you like turned them down and said that you would only work in the golf industry if it was repairing or making golf clubs. Is that story true?
That's not exactly the way that went. I'll tell you exactly how that went. Okay. There are two stories. There's two kind of stories there. This headhunter was in the pulp and paper industry, obviously. So I'd been working there about 5 years, and we get calls like that all the time because the headhunters were looking to take guys that had a little bit of experience and move them around and make some money. So I get this call one day, and it's a headhunter, and he says, "I got a marvelous opportunity for you in the pulp and paper industry." And so I said, "Listen," I just cut him off, and I said, "Listen, I said, I'm not going to work at another paper mill. This is my first and last work job at a paper mill." I said, "If you don't have a job designing airplanes or golf clubs," I said, "you're just wasting your time talking to me, because this, I'm not, you know, I've worked here 5 years. I've learned a whole lot, but, you know, having 10 days of paid vacation a year is just not going to cut it for me. You know, no holidays, no Thanksgiving, because the thing ran 24/7, you know, so
right.
I said, "My next job is going to be something I can play a little more golf." In fact, at the time, I was thinking about going and turning pro and trying to play the mini tours. What I had been saving my money. That was kind of what my plan was anyway. So he said, "Okay." So he says, "Okay, thanks a lot." So about 6 weeks later, in the middle of the summertime, I'm at my home in Meridian, Mississippi, playing in the 4th of July tournament, big tournament we have there, 4th of July. And my phone rings. It's this same headhunter. He's tracked me down at home.
Wow.
He says, hey, he says, I'm looking at an advertisement here in the Atlanta Constitution for a manufacturing engineer at McGregor Golf Company. And I said, well, where is it? Because I wasn't going to move to Boston or someplace. You know, I'm a Southern right. guy. Got to be where I can play golf all year round. He says, it's in Albany, Georgia. And I said, well, heck, I could live in Georgia. He says, you want to take a shot at, you want to take a look at that? And I said, sure. And I wasn't looking for a job at the time. You know, I was. So that's how I ended up going over to McGregor, flying over there on a weekend. Cause I say I wouldn't take a day off of my vacation. Cause that was tournament golf. That was tournament days to play golf. So I went, they agreed to see me on a weekend. I went over there and went through the plant on a Saturday. Of course, it's a 250,000 square foot building full of golf clubs. And I thought, you know, I could come over here and work a year, learn all about making clubs. Then I could go play golf. I could go try the mini tour. Then I'd know more than I know now. So I was in the office at the paper mill, trying to decide if I wanted to do that, quit and move over there and do that for a year. And I was, I finally decided, you know, that's kind of like a race car driver going to work in an engine plant. You know, I said, I don't know if that's really what I need to do, because I'm a player at the time. You know, I'm thinking I'm a player. So I write this letter, handwritten letter, turning down the job. I'm standing in my office looking at it. And I said, you know, you're just being chicken. You're just being chicken. You know, you're just being a chicken doing this. And so I took it and I crumpled it up and I threw it in the garbage can and I called the guy on the phone and I said, okay, I'll take the job. I'm coming. So I was that close to never being in the golf business right there. So I go over there and I go over there and I take that job and I get over there and I'm the only guy that can break 80 in the whole place. There are no offers there. I thought it was going to be full of old tour players making clubs.
Nope.
Nobody can play. Nobody can play.
That's amazing.
Nope. The guy running R&D shoots 100. So
that's unreal. So how did you know?
That's how I got in the golf business.
How did you know that you wanted to be in the manufacturing, engineering, design side? You know, there are so many different aspects to the industry, and obviously, being a competitive golfer, you could have gone any direction in the industry. What was the equipment that lured you?
Well, you know, I've always liked to tinker and build stuff. I was the guy in high school that would enter the science fair. You know, I built some rockets and stuff. You know, I mean, I love the machine shop. I discovered the machine shop up in college when we had to make some stuff for some classes. And that was where I got turned on to the machine shop. And I would spend all day in the machine shop. It was hard to get me out of there. If it wasn't for the golf course, I would have just lived in the machine shop. So I loved to tinker and make stuff and was always interested in how things were made, you know, what made things tick. And so, you put that together with loving to play golf, and it's a perfect matchup. You know, I would hang around at night in the club. I would hang around in the plant at night after hours and learn to grind and polish. Yep. Just that wasn't part of my job, but I just wanted to know how to do it. You know, I just thought it was great. And, I mean, before I left, I could run every machine on the production floor. I could set up and run anything in woods and anything in irons, and did. And made my, you know, I just loved to tinker. So, you know, you put that together and you start, you know, you wonder, you get involved in all that. You say, well, what makes these things work? And can I make them work? You know, I'm an engineer. I'm a mechanical engineer. Can I figure out how to make these things better, make them work better? Moments of inertia and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it was like not work for me. You know, I couldn't wait to get up and go to the plant every morning and tear myself away at night. So, and I'm still that way here. I'm same. I have never changed. So I'm just not in a, I'm not in a big factory right now. I'm in my own, I have my own machine shop here. So,
right.
So it was a perfect match of just loving to play golf, being a decent player and just loving to tinker and make stuff, you know?
Do you remember the first golf clubs that you designed and how did they come out?
Well, you know, when I first got there, I didn't know anything about how to design a golf club, how it was done. You know, I didn't know anything about it. I had to learn all that working in the plant and interfacing with some of the R&D people and a lot of the outside tool makers were really, that's where really the pedal met the metal was with the tool makers out here on the West Coast. They was the, those were the people that made the master models and all, which was really, that was really the design was building the master models because we didn't do it on a computer then. It was all,
right.
You know, hacked out of a block of metal. So I had to learn. You know, I learned as we went. I didn't know how to make a master model. I didn't know anything about a shrink master or casting, or I didn't know anything about forging. I didn't know how it was done. So I had to, you know, I was exposed to that over time working in production because my first job was basically taking something that was had already been designed and tooled up in R&D and processing it through the plant to get it to come out right, you know, working with the what grit belt you use, which operation and you know, polishing sequences and plating, stamping, paint filling, you know, bending loft and line, making, you know, doing all the assembly. That was production. That was my first job. So I learned how they were actually built in production and I was, I gained responsibility for making, you know, making production fixtures and little machines to do certain stuff and all that kind of stuff. And I was, that was, you know, that was a good match for my tinkering skills. You know, we need some, like we had some persimmon woods. We were going to put a crown stamp in the wood. And that had previously been done by hand, you know, where you stamp right. It in there. We were going to do it in production. So we had to build something where we could consistently put a nice, even stamp on a rounded woodhead. So that turned out to be a nice challenge, but we figured out a little gadget that would that we could do that with. But that was the kind of thing I was involved in before R&D, where you're actually, you know, designing the thing to start with. So
let's talk about that for just a minute here, Clay. When we're talking about design, you know, design has evolved so much. Most design nowadays, as you already referenced, it starts out on computers. And back in the day, you were just basically hacking it out of a block of steel or carving it out of a block of wood. And yep. You didn't have access to all the CAD programming. You couldn't do any prototyping and any modeling. It was very much trial and error. Try something, see if it works, refine it. Your design process, does it start off as far as where do you draw your inspiration? And are you like a sketchbook and a pencil sort of guy, or are you jumping on a CAD program and getting into it right away?
In the early days, club design was really, it was shape, look.
Yep.
You know, a woodhead had to have a certain look, a certain shape, and the face had to look a certain way, and it had to blend into the hosel a certain way, and the same way with an iron. The iron, a match set of irons, it had to have a certain shape. The toe, you know, the toe had to have a certain radius and blend a certain way, and the par had to blend a certain way in the hosel. They had to match through the set, and learning all that was part of learning to be a club designer. But it was an art, because like persimmon woods, there wasn't a whole lot of technology there.
Right.
It was a shape thing, and you couldn't, if it didn't have a good shape, you couldn't sell it. And if you right. didn't, if you didn't produce pretty shapes that good players like, you weren't a very good designer. And you know, that, like you say, that's grass now into a much more high tech way that now we can model on the computer and tell where the center of gravity is before we make the thing. So I do computer now. I've transitioned from handmade models and things like that into CAD. So
yep.
The advantage I have is that I can link up the art part from the early days to the CAD thing. And sometimes that's difficult to bridge that because the computer doesn't always want to do just what you want it to do. You know, sometimes it's right. A math machine. So that's sometimes that's quite a challenge to like for instance, on a wedge, like a classic wedge, that's still a lot of art.
Mostly shaping.
The shape is like the whole thing, pretty much. I mean, there are other things, you know, the bounce and grinds and all, but that's a shape thing. The first time I saw a parametric model update, I said, "Man, I got to know how to do that for sure." I got to know how to do that. Guy made a change on a model that would have taken 6 hours.
Right.
Just straight non-parametric CAD and did it in about 20 seconds. And I when I saw that, I said, I have to know how to do that because that can,
so that seems,
I said,
to me,
I can design so much stuff with that. I can be just like a freight train of design being able to do that, you know? So
it seems to me like that's really been the evolution. We can talk about the specific tech that's been designed for the golf clubs, but the real evolution in the design process is with computing and with some of these machines we have available to us, just the prototyping process to get through a design from start to finish, see what it looks like, be able to map out a CG based upon the CAD program, figure it out, and then look at it and say, wait a minute, that doesn't work. I need to redo this. In the past, you would have to actually make a unit, test it, and then figure out it didn't work and go back to the drawing board, which takes a lot of time.
We didn't move too far away from where we had been before for a long time. For me, it's about function. To me, it's about trying to understand, get an understanding of how things work, you know, how a ball gets hit, what makes it fly, what makes it spin, what makes it curve, what makes it go far, how that works, and then trying to go from there and figure out, okay, how can I make this better? How can I make this iron go straighter, or how can I make this driver go further? I got to understand how it works to start with. I got to understand what COR is, what component that plays in it, and aerodynamics of the head and length of shaft, weight. You got to understand the physics of the situation. And then from there, you just take a look at what you got and what do you think would be better? And that's really what has, you know, drives me, the engineer, you know, from the very beginning. Like the response putter, I mean, it had a huge inertia, you know, it was a physics thing there. It started out something else, but it ended up being a play on physics. And then you combine the art part of it, which is still important to me, that things look really good, with the physical part of it, trying to make it actually work better. And 9 times out of 10, that'll give you a new product.
And that'll do it for part one of our interview with Clay Long. Be sure to check out part two next week. And if you're looking for more gear news, be sure to check out our Twitter account. We're @fully_equipped. And Instagram, we're @fullyequippedgolf. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you around.